Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Mr. Jeremy Lee.
Well, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, that's a very ominous introduction that I got. I certainly do not have the intention of scaring the hell out of you, and that's not really why I'm here. Why I am here is to try and give you as factual a picture as I can of what is happening. And the reason I'm doing that is because I believe there is something we can do about it, although I do not have a quick, fixed solution. What we have got to have is a very wide awakening, which is then channeled into a program of regeneration that can come to grips with what is happening to Australia. It's not a quick, fixed thing at all. So I'll try and paint for you a picture of what is happening not only in this country but internationally, and why it is happening and what is behind that. And then, as the chairman said at the end, we'll have a question period, and I invite you to ask anything you want. It's not one of those question periods where we get you to write down your questions on a piece of paper and hand it up, and then I quickly flip through them to see which ones we can handle and throw the rest quietly in the waste paper basket. The question period is the most important part of this meeting. And if you don't agree with what I've said, or there's something that I haven't made clear, get up and say so. For goodness sake, I'm not here to be flattered. I'm here because I'm very worried and concerned about the future of this country. Now, over the last 20 years now, I've been speaking not only in Australia, but through Canada and New Zealand and round in this country and across Britain on a program that has been gradually developed over that time called the New World Order. And some of you have seen the videos that I've done, and others have heard audio tapes, and I'm not going to spend a long time on what is involved, because we've got to move on from there to see how it's happening and what is behind it. But very briefly, the New World Order program, just to summarize it, is a program aimed at shifting the whole decision-making process out of nations into international forums. And it is a very wide program that embraces not only economics, but also ultimately politics and cultural decisions and the very rules whereby human beings live together. And all this has been spelled out countless times, and there are thousands of documents and reports and books that deal with it. The economic part of this program is called NEO, New International Economic Order. We've had discussions on that since the early 70s. The idea in the end is that we have a world central bank that can gradually accumulate central direction over all economic systems. And behind that world bank, this central bank that would be phased in, would be a new world money system to replace the existing reserve currency systems which we trade in. And that is accompanied by international control of commodities under one division of the United Nations called UNCTAD. And in the end, it would mean that most of the decisions about economies are taken at that level, not in budgets inside nations like Australia. And alongside this economic package, there is another package that broadly deals with the social way that we live together. And it is broadly based on a totally different philosophy or a different idea about human beings and what their purpose is and how they should relate to each other. And all those ideas are now materializing in the form of conventions and declarations which all nations are being asked to build into their own legal systems. And we have a whole series of these coming into Australia. They all sound very nice when you first hear about them, until people begin to find out what they mean in practice. Just to take one example, we have something called the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination on a whole series of grounds. Sex or race or marital status or religion. And when you first hear that, it appeals to a sense of fairness and the fair-go attitude of Australians. Who wants to discriminate, and who wants division between races, and who wants some sort of religious monopoly dominating everything? So it sounds in practice very good. But by the time that thing is turned into law and begins to work its way out into the way we live together, it produces quite often the very opposite of what people thought it would mean. For example, if you lived in Cranbrook, where Murray lives now, and you went along to your local paper and wanted to put an advertisement in asking for a married couple to come and work on your farm or your property, that is now against the law. It is illegal. because the word married is a form of discrimination against unmarried people. Now, is that what you thought it meant when you first heard about the elimination of discrimination? It produces, in actual fact, the elimination of freedoms that we used to have in favor of new ideas. Or you can take another one, the Declaration on the Rights of the Child, which has produced a great argument and controversy across Australia. And the first reaction amongst many people is we do need something to protect the rights of children. But when you carefully go through the wording of that convention, you'll find that there is a price to be paid, and that is that it gradually eliminates the rights of parents. So written quite clearly into that document is the statement that parental discipline is a form of discrimination against children. Now, is that what you thought it meant when you first heard it? Because if you take that to its ultimate, it eliminates the rights of parents to decide any course of values for their kids in favor of some sort of state direction that is established instead. And all this great conglomeration of new values which are being argued and pushed into countries like Canada or America or Australia, New Zealand, are based on a new, totally new value system. In fact, it's on a new religion. And the new religion that is behind that is something called humanism that is in direct opposition to the traditional value system that we've had up till now, which, for better or worse, and this is simply a historical fact, is based on Christianity. And at the moment, Australia is caught, locked in between two totally opposed value systems. A traditional value system based on Christianity, out of which came our constitution and our laws and our courts and our justices and our juries and the whole range of those things. And we have discarded many of those, but we have not necessarily accepted this new value system. There's a large number of people groping around wondering whether there is such a thing as a value system. And at the moment we're struggling, torn between those two. And then alongside these two packages, that's the economic package and the social package, we have the ultimate, which is some type of international military police force which will enforce the decisions that ultimately are made. And that's what the war in the Middle East with Saddam Hussein was all about. It was the first time, well, not the first, but the first major time that we saw a sort of international coalition of military forces. And the idea now is that nations disarm in favor of international military forces, for better or worse. And it may be that some of these things are good, it may be that you agree with some of them, but the real question we've got to answer is, do we get asked? Or do we simply get told what we're going to have, whether we like it or not? And that, to me, is the fundamental thing, that many of these things are now being done at a level which precludes the Australian people having a say about, yes, we would like that one, but we don't want that one. We don't really get much choice. It's a package deal that is pushed in, and if it happens that we don't like it, according to the standards that are adopted, we can't do very much about it. Now, that's a very dogmatic thumbnail sketch of what I've been talking about, and if you want to go into it in more depth, well, do get a video or a tape, because the last time I was over here, we spelled out the nature of all those details in quite an extensive form. But it's my job tonight to try and go on from there. And to deal with what I see now as the crucial issue, probably transcending all material issues, that confronts us. And that issue is economic crisis and recession and, above all, debt. Now, for a long time, through the 70s and into the early 80s, international news was dominated by debt in one part of the world, which was the Third World. And we had picture after picture of third world nations struggling to build primitive economic systems, and in order to do that, borrowing huge sums of money and not having the means to repay it. And by the end of the 70s, we had queues of nations in the third world going to the banks and trying to borrow money to reschedule debts, which is simply a euphemism for borrowing money to repay what they borrowed previously. And we had something like 39 nations as we moved out of the 70s into the 80s that couldn't pay their debts. There was no way they could pay their debts. And it was on that premise that finally the international community adopted the Lima Declaration, which was the craziest idea of shifting industries out of the advanced nations into the third world nations so that they could produce what we used to produce and they could then start paying the bankers back.
You can easily close industries down in strong nations, but it doesn't mean that they automatically build up in the other ones. So as we moved into the 80s, the debt of the third world was around about $384 billion. And that has not diminished. As we meet tonight, that debt has increased up to round about $1.3 trillion. In other words, it's escalated time and time again. And in order to try and mitigate the worst effects of what is happening, which we see on our television screens, whether it's in Somalia or Angola or Mozambique or other nations that are starving, which is partly drought, it is true, but is much more linked to the fact that basic peasant systems have been destroyed, we now appease our consciences by giving out a bit of aid. Last year, for example, the Third World was given $50 billion in aid to try and do something about their debts, and the same money-lending agencies which handed out that $50 billion took back from the Third World $93 billion in debt service. So they're actually $43 billion worse off than when the aid had been given. And now the thing is breaking down into chaos. But all of a sudden, we've discovered that the debt crisis, which we once thought was the problem of the third world, is now our problem. And it doesn't matter where you look around the world, the dominating factor, so dominating that most politicians don't really want to talk about it, is the debt crisis. We've just had the most extraordinary election in the United States with two candidates going for a year, telling the people how bad the other fellow is and how much good each one will do if they're elected. And finally, after that battle, Clinton has got in as the president-elect, and his first job as he moves into the White House is to simply look at the books of Washington's debt. That is the federal debt of the United States. And as he goes into office, that debt now is $4.2 trillion. The human mind doesn't really know what the difference between a billion and a trillion is anyhow. Try and give you some sort of picture. That debt now, just of Washington, not the states and not the cities and not the industries and the corporations and the farms and the mortgages and the credit cards, just federal debt in America today is roughly the equivalent of $800 for every person on earth. From a little baby in Somalia that big to the oldest person up in the Himalayas, wherever it happens to be. And that means that every American now has to pay on Washington's debt the sum of $2 a day in interest. Now, it doesn't sound very much until you start thinking about it. Let's imagine that Clinton was suddenly spurred on by the idea of getting through to the American people the idea of clarifying how much they were paying in interest on debt. So he organizes a team of collectors, and they go out and they knock on every home in America on Monday morning, and they say, we're here to collect the interest on the federal debt, and therefore we need to count how many people in your home, and there's a mother and father and two kids, so you're up for $8 a day, which is $56 a week, and could you please put the money in the kitty now, and we'll be back next Monday morning to pick up next week's, and that'll go on right through the year. Now please don't think that this money you're putting in, $56 for your family every week, is writing off the debt, because it's not even starting to repay it. It's simply paying the interest on what we borrowed, and because of the lag, we've got to borrow more, so it'll probably go up next year. The whole of America would boil into a revolution probably in a fortnight. But you see, it's never spelled out like that so that people know exactly what's happening. It is hidden, but it's hidden in a way that has just the same impact. It's hidden in the costs of the clothes and the shoes and the groceries and the rates and the rents and the motor cars and the machinery and the capital equipment that the average American has to buy. And he knows that either he's in a small group of Americans that is getting more and more powerful as it manages to deal with this, or else it's in the majority, which is sinking back into greater and greater poverty. And the division between rich and poor in America is widening to horrific extents. To the point, for example, where you can find in California or in Florida shanty towns like you would find in Somalia outside some of the cities. You can find white beggars sitting on the streets as you walk through those cities trying to find enough for a meal for a family or even for themselves tomorrow and the next day. Things that you would have thought unthinkable in the greatest economy that the world has ever seen. Now that federal debt in Washington is only part of the crisis. If you start adding that onto all the debts, that is the states and California and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is technically bankrupt, or New York City, or all the rest of it, the total debt package for the United States is now around about $20 trillion. $20 trillion. $4,000 for every living person on Earth. And they are being now persuaded on the craziest solution of all time, and that is that the only way to get out of this debt is to get tougher and meaner and have a massive export drive, and somewhere, if they can send their cars and their produce and their farm goods out into the world, they're going to collect $20 trillion that comes back into the United States and pays their debts off. And so they are now talking quite angrily about trade wars. We declare a trade war against Europe or a trade war against Japan, while at the same time they want Japan to buy more goods. Not so long ago, Bush was over in Japan trying to persuade them to buy American cars. This is the greatest car-producing nation the world has ever seen. But they want to sell them American cars. They don't actually fit on Japanese roads, but they're going to take some rather than go to war. And caught somewhere in the middle of this growing trade war that engulfs the world is a little country called Australia. It doesn't know where to send its goods. It's not big enough, really, to make much of a noise, although we try and do it. We send our trade minister to Washington or to Brussels to try and browbeat the opposition over there, and they sort of brush us off, rather like somebody brushing off a mosquito. And they don't get too worried when Blewett turns up, as he used to do, and used to come back making statements about how he'd gone to threaten Europe or threaten America. And I never really believed that they were down in the bunker sort of hiding when they thought Blewett was coming. So that's the picture, but how does America solve that debt by exports when you begin to look at the world as a whole? Because, and I think I might have said this last time I was here, quite recently a book came out written by a top economist over in Canada by the name of Professor R.T. Naylor, who's the Dean of Economics at McGill University, and he wrote a book called Hot Money, which you can probably buy at Dimmock's or Angus and Robertson. And it tells the story of the money rackets that have developed around the world, the mafia and the drug money and the banks that have crashed and Banco Ambrosiana and the Nugent Hand Bank, and you name it, it's all there. It makes James Bond pale into insignificance when you read this stuff. But right in the beginning, he says this: as a result of the computer age, as we got to the mid-80s, we were able to do something we'd never been able to do before. We were able to put the whole of world trade onto a computer. Every trade deal from every nation, every shipment, every export, every import was all there. And finally, at the end of the year, we got a model coming out of this computer which told us that the world as a whole is now running a trade deficit with itself every 12 months. It's totally inexplicable, it's illogical, and it blows every economic theory that we've got right out of the water. We've always taught every student in economics at university, he's going to go out and advise governments and he's going to advise industries that if there was a debt in one part of the world, there'd be a credit somewhere else, and the whole thing would balance out if ever you got a picture of it. And here was the tangible proof that it didn't. The world was running a deficit with itself. So he said, we wrote to the International Monetary Fund and asked them, did they know about this and could they explain it? And they wrote back saying, yes, we are aware it's going on, we can't explain it. So we simply put it every year, as we do our figures, under the heading of something called asymmetries. And asymmetries is a marvelous word which simply means we haven't got the first clue. And you just put anything you can't explain under that. But if the world as a whole is running a trade deficit with itself, and every nation is now in what is really a new religion, tighten your belts, work harder, produce more, get more efficient, export it somewhere. And every nation in the world is trying to do this. It doesn't care whether people get the exports. It doesn't care whether they're dumped in the sea. It doesn't care whether they're simply put in lakes or mountains, so long as a check comes back from somewhere and you can go and spend it. In the end, you've got all the ingredients of the greatest conflict of all time, because military wars grow out of trade wars. Now, if you want to see this in a microcosm, look at the situation in Victoria. We've just had an election here in Australia, and a brash young guy called Jeff Kennett has got in. Jeff Kennett was going to solve the problem. He's certainly got a battle on his hands, because he got into office and he had to spend almost 3 weeks simply going through the books and finding out where they were. And by the time he'd added up where Victoria's situation was, they've got debts of $61 billion for the state, which works out at roughly $13,000 for every Victorian. How do you pay for that? You can go through all the jargon, you can do anything you want, but basically he's got an intractable problem. The people who ran up that debt got voted out of office and left, either into retirement or into opposition, with handouts that averaged round about $600,000 each. That's all the cabinet leaders in the Kerner government and Mr. Kane, who was on the backbench by then. So they haven't suffered too much. And there's Mr. Kennett. So he goes through the books, and now he's got this problem. The only thing to do is we've got to really hit the Victorian people. Up go taxes, we've got to sack some public servants. But he's got one horrible problem to face, and that is that the previous government, last year, brought in $500 million in taxes, less than they had the year before, without any tax reductions. In other words, they have crippled so many Victorian earners and producers that it doesn't matter how far you jack taxes up, there's no more money in the kitty to pay for it. And every time you load more costs onto people who are already on their knees, you don't enable them to pay those taxes. You simply drive more industries into bankruptcy, or out of the state, or even out of the country. So the next thing Mr. Kennett has got to do is he goes through to see what we can flog. And they have a lovely word to cover flogging off the assets, which is called privatization. Privatization is simply going to the pawnbrokers. It's not other Australians who buy these things, it is sold internationally. But his cupboard is pretty bare, because you go to Melbourne and all the trams are now owned by Japan. All the rolling stock in the city is owned overseas. He's sold just about every asset you can think about. They're now looking at selling the electricity commissions and Loy Yang. But even when you add up all those things, if you can get the price that you want, which you can't because it's not a seller's market, it doesn't meet the debts. So he flew into Canberra and he said, look, I've gone through everything we've got and we still can't make ends meet. Can we borrow another $2.8 billion just to tide us over? We can't do anything with it. It's just to keep us ticking. And he was met by a very smug Mr. Keating and Mr. Dawkins, who knew that this was going to happen, and rubbed their hands and said, well, we can probably borrow some more money for you. But if we're going to say yes to this, we want a say in Victoria's policy from now on. A quite open, cynical attempt from Canberra to say we want direction in a state government now. And Kennett's got no option but to say yes. And he goes back to Victoria to face some type of physical confrontation with Victorians who've had enough. They know damn well they can't take. I mean, they put $100 on every set of rates in the country. And round the rest of the country, people are saying, well, that's, you know, it's the only way to do it. We've got to be tough. But how do you get more blood out of the stone once the blood's gone? You see, it's not answering the question. Any more than if you go to Canberra and have a look at their books. Because it's easy to direct attention onto Mr. Kennett. Whatever else is said about Mr. Kennett, he didn't create the problem. Go to Canberra, where we're told by the Prime Minister that the recession is now over. Didn't we know? Well, there's an awful lot of Australians don't know about this. But then when you look at his books, we've got a foreign debt that is round about $150 billion, which has just blown out by another $1.5 billion over the last 30 days. Now, it's easy to say that. What does that mean? The foreign debt increased by $2 million every hour over the last 30 days and shows no signs of stopping. How can you talk about a recovery in Australia while that is still happening? The recovery starts the moment the foreign debt stabilizes and then begins to come down. You cannot talk about recovery while we're still hocking things up overseas and putting it on the slate like an alcoholic going to the pub and buying a beer with next month's salary, getting nice and merry, and then saying, well, I feel pretty good. So that's the situation. But in the end, the burden is not being carried by the politicians, even Mr. Kennett, who was stupid enough to increase his own salary and the salaries of his mates while he was telling Victorians what they had to do. It's the craziest thing of all time. It is borne by the little manufacturer. It's borne by the farmer. It's borne by that corner store. It's borne by the family that's struggling with its mortgage, the ordinary people, who have never been asked about these debts. They've never been approached by politicians and say, look, we're going to borrow some money, and you're the ones who are going to have to pay it back. Therefore, can we have your yes or no on the contract? None of us have ever asked if they should do these things in our name. We're simply sent the bill at the end of it. And as a result of that now, we are destroying our industries. We've destroyed them at an incredible rate. Now, just take one sector of Australia now, which is the farm industry. We'll go move on to manufacturing in the city shortly. If you go back in our history, in 1940, when we were all at war, and most able-bodied Australians were in uniform over in New Guinea or up in North Africa or wherever, here inside this country, out of a population of 7 million, we had 250,000 primary producers. 250,000 farmers, and they were doing pretty well, highly efficient, very good producers. And at the end of the war, we had a number of schemes. We had soldier settler schemes to give soldiers who'd served their country the right to get out onto a farm if they wanted. And by 1960, we had built that up to 290,000 farmers. Between 1960 and 1970, we had the first crisis. We had a major drought in the eastern states, wool collapsed, and we lost 30,000 farmers. And this produced such trauma in the bush that we had the first marches through the cities. It had never happened before. Through Perth, through Melbourne, through Canberra. Farmers got together and drove their tractors, and most city people thought, well, there's the bushies, they're always moaning, and we must have gone a bit too far this time. And so finally, in 1972, we had a new government under Mr. Whitlam came in, and they said, they told the farmers beforehand, we're going to save you. We're going to save you by bringing interest rates down and providing reasonable credit, and we'll even offer some sort of moratorium because we daren't lose our farmers. And from that time till now, we have driven 127,000 farmers off the land in Australia. 127,000. It was so bad that in 1969, the ABC produced a little book, Small Farmers in Trouble. And they had, as a result of the trauma that was going on at that time, a number of experts discussing what was going to happen, including the leader of the Country Party, was called then Doug Anthony, Deputy Prime Minister. And Doug Anthony said, look, what has happened is we've got a small number of farmers who are too small. We're going to have to get rid of round about 10%. And for the first time ever, a slogan rang to Australia, get big or get out. But he said, we're only going to have to do it once. And then when that small number have gone, it'll stabilize the industry and the rest will be able to survive. And it's never stopped. We have driven off the land 18 farmers a day for 20 years. 18 farmers a day. And he tried to sort of cover up what he was doing by saying, well, if we've got to get rid of them, we'll let them leave the land with dignity. Well, there's not much dignity about what's happening in the bush today. But to show you where we are, having got rid of that 127,000 farmers, we've just had the latest statement from the government, which came out round about 6 weeks ago, and it said another 25,000 farmers to go. Another 25,000, which takes us down below 100,000 primary producers right across Australia. It means the closing down of country schools. It means the retraction of communities, the closing of railway stations. Many small businesses will go with them. Machinery agents will close down. It just doesn't stop at the farmer. And those farmers will come down to Perth, or they'll come down to Melbourne or wherever it is to join the queues of unemployed in this country. If 25,000 is the right figure. But you see, why 25,000? There's no evidence to say that's just the limit. The only evidence we've got is a book, which is a report that's just been produced by the Catholic Church. I don't know whether any of you have seen it. It's taken 2 years to produce. It's caused a lot of controversy. I think it is absolutely excellent. I don't agree with their answers, but their analysis is careful, and they've gone through the whole Australian situation. And the evidence is devastating. And amongst the facts and figures they've produced is the fact we've now got 70% of our farmers technically bankrupt. 70%. If that is right, and nothing is done, it means 83,000 more farmers will go. And if 83,000 farmers leave the land in the next 2 or 3 years, God help Australia. God help this country. Because there's nowhere for them to go. You don't just shift them conveniently into another sector that has jobs waiting for them. You don't equip a man who's now 50 and has spent all his life on the land with the means to suddenly earn a living somewhere else in an opportunity where there is a tremendous scramble for the few jobs that exist. 83,000 farmers? God help Australia. But alongside that, when you get down out of the farming areas into manufacturing, the decimation is even more ruthless. Over that same 20-year period, we've got rid of 50% of our manufacturing sector. 50%! Hundreds and hundreds and thousands of industries which used to produce what we needed in this country have either closed down or gone overseas, and we are left now buying all the stuff we used to make ourselves from foreign countries and just putting it on the slate on the foreign debt, and we don't know how to stop. And as these two sectors, the farming world and all those industries that service them, and our manufacturing base has closed its doors in what is really carnage, we have produced the inevitable. We have produced 1 million people officially unemployed. The real figure is much higher than that. And all of a sudden, we've got politicians wringing their hands. This unemployment level is unacceptable. We're absolutely shattered. But at the same time, they say to industries, well, there's nothing we're going to do to help you. How can you wring your hands about the unemployment figures when you've got a policy of wrecking the industries which provide jobs? It doesn't make sense. I go around meeting after meeting. I speak to manufacturers, I speak to cane producers, I speak to chambers of commerce, I speak to small business associations, and inevitably there's a queue of people at the end telling me about what's happened in the clothing industry or the machinery industry or the plastics industry or whatever it happens to be. Some of the stories are crazy. A man was talking to me just before tonight, who helped us organize the meeting, about the textile industry, another company we're forcing overseas. It's really scary. I had a meeting in Bundaberg not long ago where we had a manufacturer. Took me round his factory. It's one of the best factories in Australia. It's got 4 world firsts in patents. It's a very mundane sort of thing. It makes those plastic bags that stock feed go into and cement and, you know those ones? Bundaberg Bag Factory. It's about the only one left in Australia. And they have got 4 world firsts which enable them to weave bags that people in America and Europe can't do. They seamless bags, and they can do narrow ones and small ones and ones for explosives and all the rest of it. And he showed me his stock list. He buys the plastic granules to make these bags from a firm in Sydney. $1,500 a ton. And the same product is being exported out of Australia at $790 a ton. It would do better for him to go and buy the same stuff overseas and import it back into Australia, even though it's made here. Or the manufacturer we met, he's retired now, down in Geelong, he was the engineer who designed the mouldings for the Nissan factory, and all the aluminium for the castings, which they were casting themselves, was in Melbourne. But it was cheaper for that Melbourne company to export them to Southeast Asia, and then for Nissan to go to Southeast Asia and buy the same aluminium back into Australia than to go to Melbourne and just buy it, which was next door. Or the battery manufacturer, whose battery factory closed down because they'd removed protection, and somebody said go to Asia to have a look, and he went to Taiwan, his main opposition, and he found that Taiwanese battery factory, which was not nearly as efficient as his own, he said all this stuff about Australians being no good is nonsense, we're the best in the world. But he said they were buying their lead from the same depot in Australia where I buy mine at under $800 a ton, and I pay $1,540. That's what's closing me down. So thousands of industries have been wrecked, and finally in March of this year, Time magazine, I don't know whether you saw this particular issue, that was March 1992, did a survey on what we've done to industries here in Australia. I can't read you the whole thing. They started off with a story of a little shirt company over in Sydney, which had closed these doors, and he'd gone across to Fiji, and he'd put his factory there, and so the reporter went across to Fiji and interviewed him. Why did you move to Fiji? Well, he said, I couldn't survive in Sydney. It was either Fiji or bankruptcy. And he said, I've got a wife and kids, so I came to Fiji. But what's the factor? He said, well, the factor was I had to pay Australian workers $540 a week, and I couldn't pay that. Oh, well, what do you pay Fijians? He said, $150 a month. But he said, even that wasn't enough to convince me. He said, the thing that convinced me was the Fijian government had a cheap factory at nominal rents, and they told me they give me 13 years without any taxes if I shifted across. And he said, I'm doing very well, thank you. I can even take my weekends off and go fishing. Could never do that in Sydney. And people say, well, oh, they are there. That just proves it. Australians' wages are too high. But you see, that's only half the story. Because the man on $540 a week in Sydney can't live unless he sends his wife out to work. Why not? Why not? I'll tell you why not. You just try this out for yourself. Write to your federal member of parliament and say, please send me one figure for all the taxes taken by Canberra. Just one figure. All the direct taxes and the indirect taxes. So you've got the total in the budget. And then get the figure, which you can get from the Department of Statistics, for what the states take in taxes, whether it's Western Australia or Victoria, all the rest. And then get the figure, which is also available, for what our councils take in rates and charges. And add up the three tiers of government and the three taxes that they levy, add them all up, average them out right across Australia, and they come to $530 every 7 days for every four Australians. Paid in that petrol tank, or they paid in the electric goods, or they paid in a whole lot of hidden costs. And that is why the wage of $540 is not enough to keep a wife who wants to stay at home with the kids at home. And the government, which tells everybody else to tighten their belts, won't cut its own fat back. It won't even say, now look, if we're going to ask the nation to accept lower wages, as an example, we'll take a 10% cut ourselves as a sign of good faith. The first government that did that would begin to be believable. I'll guarantee you that won't be a promise in this coming federal election, whenever it's going to be. And so the article went on. This is what it said. Since 1990, Australian business has been moving north to Asia rather than to Europe and the United States. Some companies have left Australia completely, while others have gone into joint ventures. Many familiar names are on the list of companies that have gone overseas. Email, Plessy, STC, Cambrook, Bung, ICI, CUB, James Hardy, BHP, BTR Nilex, Amcor, the Linter Group, Olex, Tube Makers Australia, Meadow Lea Foods, Sierra Lee, Gadsden, Maine Nicholas. Pacific Dunlop has shut Australian subsidiaries across a range of industries and reopened them overseas. And then you get into clothing and textiles, and it's really carnage. Many parts of the Australian clothing industry are now virtually based overseas, much of it in China and Fiji. Since 1990, about 60 fashion clothing manufacturers have moved either all or part of their operations overseas, including companies such as Country Road, Sportscraft, Yakka. You ever heard of a more authentic Australian name than Yakka? Overseas now. Holeproof, Burleigh, Trent Nathan, Palmer Corporation, Matilda Clothing. And that's just the start. There are others following them, one after the other, because it's either do that or go overseas. This country is being raped economically, because every company that closes its doors means another group out on the dole queue and another lot of costs, which make us even less competitive. The latest assessment I've got from a small business group in Melbourne, which have done a survey now through the banks, is that between now and the middle of next year, unless something changes, there's a potential 60,000 more businesses to close down. And if that happens, they between them now employ something in the region of 400,000 Australians. Add that 400,000 more unemployed under what we've got now, and what do you think Australia by Christmas 1993 is going to be like? God help us if we don't wake up. And yet there is so much going for this country, if we could only just see it. Now, it's not only happening here, this is happening in America. I've got a friend of mine who sells my videos in the United States, who is the biggest farm photographer in America. And his photographs go in all the farm newspapers, and he sends me over the Farmers Union paper. They are losing farmers by the millions there. And he sent over the last one. There was a huge delegation of farmers flying in before the presidential election to say to Bush and Clinton, if you don't keep protection on for our farmers, you might as well kiss goodbye to the family farm in this country. The only group that's been successful are the farmers in France. And they say to that French government, you dare drive us off the land, and we'll burn the place down. And so far, they got the politician petrified. But we believe the farmers in France are the enemy for daring to say they want to stay on the farm. It's the logical thing to do. Why can't we say, why can't we have one leader in this country who will get up and say, I'm going to fight to the death to make sure we don't lose any more factories and any more farms. And we're going to build back into Australia the things that we've lost. He'd have the nation behind him, that guy. He'd have the nation behind him. If you want to get the final picture of what the Catholic report said, this is the Australia of 1992 as we move now. What are we? 6 weeks from Christmas? 7 weeks? We have 2 million Australians who live in poverty and distress. We have 680,000 children who live in homes in which no one has an income-producing job. 70% of Australia's remaining farmers are technically bankrupt. Families earning between 20,000 and 40,000 a year, that's just ordinary Mr. and Mrs. Middle Australia, have suffered a 20% drop in their share of national income since 1975. Australia has an estimated 25,000 children who are homeless. In this country, our current overseas debt, over $150 billion, averages out at just under $9,000 for every living Australian, $36,000 for the average family of four, and we're bumping that up by $2 million an hour. In December 1991, there were 210,000 on the waiting list for homes. As a result, about 100,000 live permanently in caravans, and another 100,000 are homeless. Two out of three Australians owe more than they own. Two out of three Australians owe more than they own. For people on average incomes, the cost of buying a first home doubled between 1983 and 1988. In the most blessed, fantastic, rich country in the world. And that's where we are. Now, it is my conviction that this is not stupidity. It's not just craziness. This is a game plan. And the game plan is being remorselessly played out and is going to ultimately end in its culmination unless we find enough Australians who will jack up on this thing. Because if they don't jack up, they're going to lose their country. Just a few quick things. A gentleman called Mr. Gorbachev came out in May, on May the 8th, with a major statement that came right through the world. He's out of power now. But he's still making the running around the world. Gorbachev calls for global government. This came out in the Toowoomba paper. It came out, I subsequently discovered, right around the world. And his statement was, Gorbachev told a crowd of thousands sprawled in the streets and on nearby lawns, this was in Fulton, Missouri, that an awareness of the need for some kind of global government is gaining ground, one in which all members of the world community would take part. Now, Gorbachev is onto something. He's part of a program. That program was spelled out 1 month later in a major article that came out in Time magazine. And that article in Time magazine was headed for Where the World Split, and it was dealing with the economic crisis that's engulfing the world, and they said, we've got two options. Those two options are, we all accept GATT. GATT is a thing called the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trades. It's been running since 1947. It has broken down every time they've tried to get it going. That's almost 50 years, 40 years. Just broken down again. The idea of GATT is we stop protecting all industries and we have a world-level playing field. What that would mean, I believe, is that all industries on a national basis would be destroyed and a number of multinationals would control the world's production and would seek out the lowest wage base to operate. If they can't get that low wage base in Australia, they'll go to Thailand, or Fiji, or China, or India. And you can see this happening now. There's just an open competition. Who will work for the cheap? It's another form of global feudalism. You've got factories now in Thailand, for example, producing Nike shoes that we all go crazy about, advertised by John McEnroe. But if you only knew, those shoes that we pay $100 a pair for are made in factories in Thailand, where Thai women work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 82 cents a day. And it's destroying them. We didn't do that in the Industrial Revolution. We don't want to know about the conditions, we just want to know about the shoes, because you've got to have designer labels if you're going to get on in this hard, tough world. Those shoes are made out of the blood of families and kids. And you can find that with just about every product. And those shoes are also made at the expense of Australians who used to make shoes and now are out on the unemployment queue. Now they said, if we don't accept GATT as the last chance for mankind, what is going to happen is the world is going to split into three warring trade blocks. First one is Europe, which they're trying to put together under the Maastricht Treaty. And you'll see all the ingredients. They want a central European bank. They want a new monetary system in Europe. They want all the nations to hand in their parliamentary decisions to Brussels. John Major has staked his future on it. And there's more and more Britons saying, look, we don't want to lose Westminster and our own parliament. And he's really having a battle now. The second block is NAFTA, North American Free Trade Association. Pieced together by George Bush, we bring Canada and the United States and Mexico and Latin America into one giant block to take on and thrash Europe. And if you want to see the end result of what that block is going to mean for the Americans and the Canadians, go along the Mexican-American border and you will find what they call a corridor now, called the Maquiladores. And along that corridor, right on the border, they've got a narrow strip with 2,000 multinational factories there. Yes, they're American-based, but they don't employ Americans, they employ Mexican peasants who come in. They're not allowed into the States, but they work in the factories and go back into Mexico, $2 a day. And that gives a fat profit to sell high-priced goods up into the United States, where they've got 10 million people out of work. But if Americans will come down to $2 a day, well, perhaps they'll get a share of it too. The Maquiladores. It's just an equivalent to what we're doing in Thailand. And then on top of that, we now have an organization called PGA, Parliamentarians Global Action. Now, it's been going some time, this organization. It originally started out with the title Parliamentarians for World Order. Its headquarters is in New York in the United Nations. You're not allowed to be a member of it unless you're an elected member of parliament in some parliament around the world. And at the moment, it's got 650 members of parliament who are members of this thing in 50 nations, including 32 federal members of the Australian Parliament who are members of PGA. They changed the name from Parliamentarians for World Order to Parliamentarians for Global Action. Now think about that for a moment. We elect federal members of parliament to Canberra. They go in there and they take an oath of loyalty. And that loyalty is to Her Majesty the Queen and the Constitution and to their electors and the country of Australia. And then they join an organization whose objectives are world government with enforceable world law. They never come back and say at election time, that's what I'm standing for, would you vote for me? They don't even tell the Australian voters that's what they're in. But we've got 32 members of the federal parliament who are members of that organization. We don't know all their names. We've got all the Canadian names, we've got the New Zealand names. We only know one in Australia, and that's John Langmore, a Labour member of parliament who's the head of the group. They've just issued a statement through their pamphlets coming out of New York, which calls for the completion of world government by the 50th anniversary of the United Nations, which happens to fall on the 26th of June, 1995. Global governments and international institutions. We've got the whole photocopy of the statement they've just issued. So we've got federal members of parliament now quite openly working for world government and members of an organization committed to that. If we've got any doubt about this, we have here in Australia something called the United Nations Association. It runs meetings in Perth and other capital cities. Their newsletter not so long ago issued this statement. Some people still cannot accept the United Nations as the world government. Perhaps because big government seems frighteningly powerful. United Nations structure and authority are democratic and responsive. The world government structure is not perfect, but it is adequate and we are improving it. It is worth our loyalty. Anarchy is worse than big government. And those who are not committed to the rule of the United Nations law are anarchists. Well, I've got to confess that under those definitions, I'm an anarchist, because I don't accept world government. I accept the idea that Australians make their own laws through their own parliament and their own constitution, and that if ever we lose that, we've lost this country. That's the document I believe in, which says that the rightful owners of this country are the Australian people. So that's where we go, and that's where we are at the present time. The Australian newspaper has just done a series of articles on what is going to happen over the next 7 years if we continue on the program towards globalism. And these articles, in which 22 world experts wrote their articles, was called Creating the Future. You might have seen them. They had huge two-page double spreads. And one writer, writing about the sort of economy in Australia, who now incidentally is the chief advisor to the new President Clinton, a man called Robert Rake, this is his description of the Australia of the future. The changes now taking place in world capitalism will fundamentally reshape the politics and economics of the coming century. There will be no national products or technologies, no national corporations, no national industries. There will no longer be national economies, at least as we have come to accept them. All that will remain rooted within national borders are the people who comprise the nation. There will be no national products or technologies, no national corporations, no national industries, he argues. There will no longer be national economies, at least as we have come to accept the concept. All that will remain rooted within the national borders are the people who comprise the nation. Yes, Australians will still live here, but they won't own anything, because we won't have an Australian manufacturing industry. We won't have an Australian agricultural industry. We won't have an Australian economy. If we haven't got an Australian economy, why have a parliament in Canberra? How can a parliament bring down a budget if it hasn't got a national economy? What does it do there except increase its own salary? And yet, you know, we haven't had one politician of either party has got up and forthrightly said, we reject that in favour of the continuation of Australian ownership and sovereignty. Not one. Not one has come out and said, we now stand against the globalism of Australia in favour of the Constitution and the Australian people. So I don't see any choices in the coming election. I wish I could say to you, look, one's better than the other. It's only just rearranging the chairs on the deck as the Titanic goes down. But to try and keep us propped up as we go ahead, we're all going into privatization. The incoming government, if it happens to be Mr. Hewson, is going to rearrange the taxes, for better or worse. You can make up your own mind on that. I've got a pretty firm opinion on it. But that leaves an $8.5 billion shortfall on revenue, which is going to be met by privatization. What do we flog next? What do we sell? The dams up in the Stirling Ranges? They're selling the dams in New Zealand now that provide the water to Wellington. They're trying to privatize that. Or do we privatize Parliament House? And then rent it back? I mean, we've done that with everything else. Where does this thing called privatization stop? It sounds so logical. It is sold under the idea we're returning to free enterprise. It's not going back to free enterprise. It's going back to international control and ownership. It's not as though Australians have equity in these things. That's not what happens. We've sold the trams, we've sold the trains. I was lecturing across on Kangaroo Island not long ago. The ferry across from the mainland to Kangaroo Island is owned by Malaysia now. We're privatising the prison services up in Queensland. I don't know whether you've started on that. That's the greatest racket of all time. Because if you want to see what happens in the end, go and have a look at America. We've just had a book come out written by one of the prisoners who was writing in prison. He said they've turned the prisons into cheap labour factories for multinationals. They're keen to get the longest prison sentences of all time. Because once they've got us in prison, they just send us out to work every day in factories, producing stuff which is beating the heck out of industries trying to pay full wages. So the multinationals come in and privatize the prisons. They're selling Loy Yang in Victoria, one of the biggest power stations. We're now trying to flog the Commonwealth Bank. Where does it end up? Now, what have we done so far? If you want to get a picture, there was an article last weekend in your West Australian on the Saturday on foreign ownership. I don't know whether you saw it. It was very well done. That was only a fraction of the story. I just took a few of the facts out of that and a number of others that have come out in the Financial Review. Here's a summary. Overseas ownership has doubled in the last 5 years in Australia and is now worth $300 billion. That works out at $18,000 for every living Australian that we have sold overseas. But we're increasing that by $20 billion a year. That's the rough increase in the amount of foreign ownership, buying Australian businesses and assets. The $1.3 billion that's being offered for Arnott's Biscuits factory is only one of dozens of offers that are being made every other day now. Yes, Arnott's has caught the headlines for a short while. It's only been here 100 years. But for every Arnott's that's going down the drain, there's little factories and farms and communities that are going down with it. 60% of metropolitan papers are now foreign-owned. The Fairfax Press is gone. News Limited is really international now. Channel 10 is just being bought by an overseas corporation. 70% of the items in our supermarkets and shops are now manufactured or made by foreign-controlled companies. 70%. So even with an Ausbuy guide, you're really pushing it uphill to find something that is made in Australia by an Australian company. 3,000 applications to the Foreign Investment Review Board every year, 2,000, are now for real estate in Australia. And so far, we have sold to overseas ownership 10% of the whole continent. Where do we stop? Now, on November the 1st, which was the day that I flew in, the Weekend Australian carried a very, very significant article by Santa Maria. He skirted round this issue for a long time, but this time he put his finger right on it. And I just want to read one or two of the things he said, because we've got to answer this question. He said, 5 years ago, the American economist David Hale of Chicago's Kemper Financial Services, who's supposed to know more about Australia's economy than any other American expert, offered a significant observation to the Australian. Australia, he said, was on the verge of becoming the next Mexico. Irresponsible New York investment banks were giving Australia enough rope to hang itself, he said. Speaking of the same good friends who kept on feeding hot money into Australia, another American economist said they would do anything for a fee. So Victoria's Loy Yang, the SECV, and other public instrumentalities will follow the same road of privatization as Qantas, Australian Airlines, and other well-known names. The fashion was set by Mrs. Thatcher's pioneering privatizations, which have now ended in the fiasco of Britain's coal industry, and which may yet bring down her successor. An ancillary invention originated in the United States was the technique of debt for equity swaps. Remember that phrase, debt for equity swaps. To choose one example, United States car companies purchased Mexican debt from United States banks at a discount and then swapped the debt for cheap car plants south of the Rio Grande. Then there was Citibank's attempt to buy Mexico's national telephone company, thus helping to solve Mexico's debt problem by exchanging unrepayable debts for real assets. Numerous other privatizations are in process in Latin America. They are also on the menu in Yeltsin's Russia, where by exciting a nationalist reaction, they are helping to destroy his government as well. There seems to be a strange logic in the process, despite David Hale's use of the word irresponsibility, to describe the conduct of New York investment houses in forcing money down the throats of poor simpleton nations like Australia. At the end of the day, who finished up with the title to the real assets? Are we really to believe, and this is the question, are we really to believe that the world's most acute financial minds have finished up in the highly advantageous position of exchanging book entries for real assets by the purest accident without a modicum of pre-planning? Somehow it is hard to believe. To believe that these vast sums escalating astronomically through compound interest will ever be repaid is the purest fantasy. But while they remain on the books, they furnish a useful formula for the transfer of real assets, public utilities of every type, from debtors to creditors. Why don't we stop kidding ourselves? Except that compound interest or usury is the heart of the worldwide problem, and that unless we can devise a financial system on a new and different basis, we are all equally lost. In other words, the whole world is bankrupt, industries are collapsing, and the people who created this money out of nothing and have tacked on as a bill to every nation, are now saying, hand in your assets and your industries and your utilities, and we'll write some of the debt off. Not just to Australia, but to virtually every producing nation, including Japan. What a formula. Because you end up owning the whole lot. And you'll notice the one thing that is never discussed is, how does the debt start in the first place? Who creates the money? Is it created out of nothing, or who makes it? How is that debt spread round? Who actually controls the world's debt? How can the world be running a deficit with itself? You're allowed to discuss everything else. We can have endless discussions about the GST. We can discuss tariffs till we're blue in the face. We can discuss battles against the trade unions, or trying to force wages down, or privatization, or we can discuss protection or the level playing field. We can have long intellectual discussions about whether interest rates should go up or down, or whether we should have monetary policy or fiscal policy, or freezes or squeezes, or cooling or heating, or macro or micro, but you're never allowed to discuss how money is created. Have you noticed? And if we don't come to that one, we're gone. Now, let me try and finish by summarizing just a few things. We've done this before. This is the second time round for Australia. We went through this same crisis with a slightly different result in the 30s. And in 1934, not very far from here, down in Fremantle, there was a young Australian standing for the Federal Parliament. And he issued his pamphlet out, and he was dealing with this crisis, and this is what he said. He said, the year 1930-31 was the most disastrous financial policy in the history of the world. In Australia and elsewhere, the financial position of governments and private enterprise was so acute that a general collapse was only narrowly averted. In that year, private banks called up overdrafts, raised the rate of interest, and enjoyed substantial profits by taking a heavy toll of government and industry. Therefore, if you vote for me, he said, 1934, we propose to extend the scope and powers of the Commonwealth Bank until complete control of banking and credit is in the hands of the nation. The Commonwealth Bank will be developed on the following lines: a nationwide trading bank handling the ordinary business of the community, the savings bank performing the ordinary functions of such a bank, and a credit financier system for the purpose of providing advances to primary producers and home builders. We will go back to the original charter of the Commonwealth Bank, which was removed in 1924, and which incidentally had financed Australia through the First World War for 0.5% interest rates. And then he went on, the object of the bank will be to make advances on approved securities at a minimum rate of interest consistent with the maintenance of the bank on a sure and safe foundation. By the concentration at the outset of all public accounts in the Commonwealth Bank, greater efficiency will be achieved and more Australians standing for the Federal Parliament. And he issued his pamphlet out, and he was dealing with this crisis, and this is what he said. He said, the year 1930-31 was the most disastrous financial policy in the history of the world. In Australia and elsewhere, the financial position of governments and private enterprise was so acute that a general collapse was only narrowly averted. In that year, private banks called up overdrafts, raised the rate of interest, and enjoyed substantial profits by taking a heavy toll of government and industry. Therefore, if you vote for me, he said, 1934, we propose to extend the scope and powers of the Commonwealth Bank until complete control of banking and credit is in the hands of the nation. The Commonwealth Bank will be developed on the following lines: a nationwide trading bank handling the ordinary business of the community, the savings bank performing the ordinary functions of such a bank, and a credit financier system for the purpose of providing advances to primary producers and home builders. We will go back to the original charter of the Commonwealth Bank, which was removed in 1924, and which incidentally had financed Australia through the First World War for 0.5% interest rates. And then he went on, the object of the bank will be to make advances on approved securities at a minimum rate of interest consistent with the maintenance of the bank on a sure and safe foundation. By the concentration at the outset of all public accounts in the Commonwealth Bank, greater efficiency will be achieved and more attractive conditions can be offered. Rates of interest can be substantially reduced. The bank will then carry out the intention of its founders to support and stimulate industry. Now, basically what he was saying is if we cannot regain the constitutional control in this country of our own right to issue our own money at the rate that industry requires it, we're going to lose control. And we've got to do that now in Australia. You see, if we could say to Victoria, okay, you've got big problems, but the first thing is we will reconstruct the government's debt so that it is not paying 10% interest on what it owes, but 1% or 1.5%, and then the saving on that interest rate we will put back into the community in cost reductions so that industry can get back on its feet. Victoria could climb out of this mess. And suppose we then had a government big enough to say the same thing to the nation. That little company that is going overseas, we'll offer you what Fiji is offering you to stay here, because we need you. We need you to give young Australians jobs. And the ones that have gone overseas will give you the opportunity to come back, because Australia comes first. And that is never going to happen until there is such a roar of anger in this country that every politician of every party shakes in his shoes and says, right, yes, we've been wrong, Australia comes first from now on. And we're not going to do that in any federal election, let me tell you. It's got to be a type of campaign that brings people together. In other words, we've got to do something that we haven't done since New Guinea or Africa during the last war. If you were in uniform on patrol in New Guinea during the last war, or up in North Africa, in the desert, give young Australians jobs. And the ones that have gone overseas will give you the opportunity to come back, because Australia comes first. And that is never going to happen until there is such a roar of anger in this country that every politician of every party shakes in his shoes and says, right, yes, we've been wrong, Australia comes first from now on. And we're not going to do that in any federal election, let me tell you. It's got to be a type of campaign that brings people together. In other words, we've got to do something that we haven't done since New Guinea or North Africa during the last war. If you were in uniform on patrol in New Guinea during the last war, or up in North Africa in the desert, you didn't ask the person behind you whether he was a trade unionist or whether he was a manufacturer or a farmer. And if so, you didn't want to be associated with him. You asked him whether he'd done his training and whether he could shoot straight. And we've got to have a movement that is big enough now to bring Australians together on a scope that has never been done before. We've got to have wage earners fighting alongside small manufacturers and businesses. We've got to have city fighting alongside the country. We've got to do the impossible, and we've got to get men fighting alongside women instead of against them. I was talking like this in Newcastle the other night, and a bloke got up right in the back row and he said, you ain't been introduced to my wife, he said. She was sitting right alongside him, and she pulled him round that quick, it wasn't true. But you know that all these things, all these little divisions between us are, I believe, artificially created. Everybody thinks we can only survive by taking on the next door Australian. We've got to belt him down somehow. But occasionally we come together. We came together when we didn't want the ID card. And what a roar of anger went through Australia, and the politicians just went to water. And they had to wait till we'd all gone asleep again before they began to bring it back. But for a brief moment, we showed what happens when the nation comes together. And the call to Australia now is, can we save our farms, our factories, our future, rebuild jobs, get this country back into the hands of Australians, buy it back from foreign ownership, and above all, save the Constitution so that we've got something to hand on to our kids after the year 2000. And if we don't do it, there's a time coming when Australians in the year 2010 will look back at us and they'll curse us because we hadn't got the guts to fight for this country while we still had a chance. Now, people say, oh, well, you know, very dramatic stuff, but what do we do? If you say there's no solution in the coming federal election, what do we do? And I haven't got a quick, slick solution. I wish I could tell you, we've got instant coffee there. Just buy two packets, put it in the cup, put the hot water on, and that's going to fix it up. We're in a battle for Australia. It's the toughest battle we've ever had. And the first thing we've got to do in that battle is we've got to find Australians who do a little bit of training. And that type of training is we've got to learn how to make things work. So what I'm trying to do is a long-term thing. It's a bit longer than the next election in March. What we've got to do is to find small numbers of Australians who will train on the principles of effective social defence. And so I'm running a seminar, as Murray said, and that seminar is basically a leadership training school. It goes for 2.5 days. It's in-depth stuff. It's taken us 2 years to put this thing together. And the theme of the seminar is simply the mechanics of the free society. How does freedom work? What is freedom? How is it we're losing it? And to make it operate, we get those who want to do it together on a Friday evening at 6:30, and we go right through to 10:30 at night. We've got to come back again at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning and go right through to 10:30 at night. Come together again at 9 o'clock on the Sunday and go right through to 6. It's all Saturday, all Sunday, and 4 hours on a Friday evening. And this stuff has been put together professionally on videos, step by step by step, with lectures in between. And it just goes through building blocks. We start on simple things like our heritage. What is common law? How was common law put together? How is it being attacked? How did the jury system start? Where did we get our constitution? And you know, that stuff used to be taught to our kids around about the age of 14 back in the 30s. We don't teach any Australian that now, except for a few very lucky ones in odd schools where they got hold of it. How can you have a nation defending itself if its young people haven't even been taught the basics of its heritage? And then we come together on Saturday morning and we have one picture. This is your Australia today. What's happened to the Constitution? What's happened to our laws? What's happened to our debts? What's happened to our industries? What's happened to our defense system? And by the end of that, you feel like, pow. And then we start just on building blocks. How do we make one thing happen? What are the principles of effective action? You can get 50,000 people marching through Melbourne now in a great dramatic rally and nothing changes. The politicians don't even stop drinking coffee. They know you've got to go home again. It's like the grand old Duke of York marching up the hill and down again. But you can get one person who knows how to put a movement together and you can change a whole community. I've just seen it done on the Eyre Peninsula. One farmer organized the whole community from Port Lincoln right up to Ceduna. All the little businesses, all the wives, all the farmers, all the truckies, all the shopkeepers. And they said, do we all unite to take on the banks and stop any bankruptcies? And the way they did it was brilliant. It was just a planned operation. Nobody ever went to see his bank manager on his own. No bank could hold an auction or foreclose or put up a for sale sign without the permission of the community. It was just a planned military operation. They haven't had one bank foreclosure for 18 months. And the banks come now and ask permission when they want to do anything. Because one person knew how to make it work. Now we go through all that step by step, building principles. There was no violence, let me say. It wasn't a sort of physical confrontation at all. It was just a tactical battle. Go through all that, and then finally we come to a full day just on how the debt system works and what we could do to get Australia out of this mess. And the stuff there that would blow your mind. I might tell you that I ran this seminar in Melbourne not very long ago, and we had an international banker came and did it. He worked for one of the top international banks. He had done 7 years economics, and he had an honours degree, and he sat through this stuff with his mouth open. I thought we were going to have a war all the way through. And he came to me the final evening, just over a cup of coffee, he said, I've never looked at this stuff before. This is mind-blowing stuff. He said, I can see a way through this. We've had students without jobs have gone through it and said, look, I've got some hope out of this thing. I'm not going to hang myself anymore. We've got to have a vision of a different Australia and how to get it. And do you know that that different Australia is there now? It's the most magic country. If we only could just get the scales off our eyes and see what we've got. Just imagine a hypothetical situation where the whole world drops beneath the sea tomorrow except Australia. We can't export anything, we can't import anything, not through choice, I'm not advocating this, but that's the physical facts. Huge great earthquakes and the world's gone except us. Here we are sitting in the sea, we've got 17 million people, our economists and politicians walk around with a lost look on their faces. They can't play macro, micro, freezing, squeezing anymore, that's all out. So they all drop dead of a heart attack, number one plus. And then ordinary people get out their pens, like a housewife looking after her family, or a man looking after his business, and you just ask simple questions. We've got 17 million people here, we've got to survive, can we feed ourselves here? And the answer is 10 times over if you look at the facts. Then why have we got 25,000 people, kids without homes, and people actually going through the rubbish bins trying to find something to eat? And school programs feeding kids because their parents can't feed them. That's happening in Australia. If we had to do it, could we clothe ourselves here? Are we all going to streak around naked? And I once worked out if we had to use our wool industry, forget cotton, we're a big cotton producer, every living Australian would get 68 suits and 127 blankets every 12 months. So we haven't got to streak around naked. And do you know there are thousands of Australians can't afford one wool blanket? Could we house ourselves? We've got 210,000 people on housing lists sitting there. Just imagine a situation where we said to the building industry, forget about tourist hotels, forget about government departments, forget about office blocks, forget about bureaucracies, the whole building industry, go flat out to put a roof over every Australian's head. People come before departments. We'd fix it in about 2.5 years. We've got enough energy. We've got it coming out of our ears. Natural gas up in this state that's bigger than Bass Strait. Oil right across from Geraldton to Moonee. Oil shale that would keep the world going for 150 years if we had to use it. Have we got enough minerals? We've got 92 out of 94 minerals known to mankind in this country. We are sitting in the most fantastic country in the world. There is no country that's got more going for it. What we've got to do is get it back and keep it. Yes, share it with other countries, but not at the expense of our own sovereignty. And Australians come first and our kids come first, and then we'll help the rest. And it can be done if we build an army of people who believe in us. And the final thing is we've got to get back to some spiritual principles. We've got to get back to some values. We've got to get back to spiritual foundations in this country or we're finished. I'm not a preacher. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not going to start evangelizing you. But I just want to make the observation there has never been a people or a community that survived without some spiritual value system which was the undergirding of the whole thing. It's education, it's law, it's government, it's values, it's honesty, it's relationships between men and women, the whole thing. And we've lost that. We're losing it. You see, there is a power greater than politicians. Far, far greater. You can't get Mr. Keating to believe that, but it happens to be true. There is a creator. And if we get in the right situation and acknowledge that, there is some help available that changes things. And we've got to get back there, and we'd better do it quickly, because we haven't got too much time. Thank you very much.